Okay, welcome everybody. First, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here to give a talk. I'm an experimentalist. I'm a PhD student in the group of Davide Annunzi at the VU University in Amsterdam. Here is Davide a few years ago. Also me a few years ago when I still had long hair. This is a technician that helps with all the electronics and another collaborator. The title of my talk is a new experimental setup for high statistics measurements of the Casimir force, and the thing is high statistics. And we will show you how we treat all the errors and how we measure them and so on. Well, first a very short introduction, since you are all familiar. In 1948, Henri Casimir predicted a force between perfectly conducting plates. This is an impression, an artistic impression made at Bell Labs. I think it's a very nice one. In 1956, Lifshitz generalized the theory to keep into account the real dielectric properties of materials, and for very small separations, this theory also has the van der Waals limit in it. Okay, so that's it. Now, what is the motivation of my work? We want to check the dependence of the Casimir force on the dielectric properties. We want to investigate how changing the dielectric properties changes the force. And we know the theory, but we want to check experimentally that it goes in the right way. For that, Davide, when he was at the Bell Labs, still he designed an experiment to measure the force between hydrogen switchable mirrors. And the hydrogen switchable mirrors are materials that, when they are in air, they're reflective. So you see the knight here reflected in the material. And when you fill the environment with hydrogen gas, the material becomes transparent and you can look through the metal film. So this is a material that when you just put in a hydrogen atmosphere, it will absorb the hydrogen and become transparent. As soon as you take the hydrogen out, so you take away the hydrogen atmosphere, the hydrogen will come out of the sample and it will go back into a metallic and reflective state. So it would be nice to check the force when you switch, when you turn the hydrogen bottle, and the flow on, flow off, flow on, flow off, it should change all the time. So that's what we want to do. David did this experiment in 2004. At Harvard University, and in green and in red you see the two states, the force at the two states, and there was no difference within the experimental error. So far they could not observe it. So we were trying to do it. The resolution of this experiment was not that good, so we think that by improving the resolution we can maybe do it.
But just spectroscopically, I mean, it makes a nice image what we can see, but what is the difference in the spectra that you...
Yeah, that depends a lot on the material. There is really a huge collection of these materials now. This material was first found in yttrium to this effect at the University of Amsterdam, where I am. But there are now really is a huge amount. We have magnesium nickel, magnesium titanium, scandium, magnesium scandium, and there are a lot of materials that exhibit this effect and all have their own peculiar properties. So you cannot give a bulk value. I did a calculation in my master thesis to calculate the change what you expect for a certain mirror, in this case magnesium to nickel, the one what was used in the experiment. If you look purely at the dielectric properties of the film, you expect a change around 40% due to the change in dielectric properties. There's a problem that typically those are coated with a very thin palladium layer to promote the hydrogen absorption. And this is the top layer, and the top layer stays metallic and screens the difference in dielectric properties.
How thick is that layer?
Typically 5 nanometers.
Nanometers?
Yeah. And then the force reduces to around 20%, theoretically. So it's still big.
When you said 40% is in the optical?
40% is doing the whole range. It's taking the optical data and fitting a model, and then using a Hall effect and a resistivity measurements to estimate the Ruder parameters, then calculating the dielectric function, and then calculating the force.
So what resolution do you need to see the difference in your future experiment?
Well, not so big. I mean, if a change of 20%, if you have a force resolution of 10%, you can already see it. Depends also on the amount of statistics you do. But we come to that later.
You're saying a 40 nanometer layer makes only a whatever percent change?
5 nanometer.
5 nanometer.
Yeah, halves the change in the force.
Okay, so it's not such a metal you can see through.
You can still see through 5 nanometers. Okay, so what is our experiment? Now, we started with a normal AFM. I did this during my master thesis. So you have a cantilever, which is a thin rectangular beam that can bend. Underneath, there's a sphere glued, which is typically polystyrene, coated with a gold layer. You have a gold-coated plate below that you can move up and down. With that, you can vary the separation. If there's a force, the cantilever bends, thereby changing the optical path. And this you detect on a quadrant photodetector, and you can detect the bending of the cantilever. It's a commercial system. The force, I mean, if you do the simple Casimir, perfectly conducting plates thing, you see that at 1 micron with a radius of 100 micron, you have 0.26 piconewton. At 100 nanometers, 258 piconewton. And these are forces that are in the right order for an atomic force microscope. It's just an atomic force microscope has the right resolution to observe this kind of thing. I want here to make a remark. The AFM we use is in fact the same model and brand as the one that is used by George Palazantzas in Groningen. In fact, he's just using the instrument like I was doing in the master thesis, but I found that the data was not reproducible enough. So I invested 2 years to make the system more complicated and more reproducible.
When you say F Casimir, you're using the low temperature limit at 1 micron separation.
Yeah. So it's just to give an order of magnitude.
Is it good to that? I don't know. Yeah.
No, we saw the measurements with the theory.
Right. So that I'm asking what was the theory.
Zero temperature.
So you say you can measure less than piconewton?
No, I'm saying what the forces more or less should be, but with an AFM you can measure less than piconewton. Yes.
Okay.
So I work now for 2 years on my PhD to implement the improvements to the setup. It's much more complicated than a normal AFM, and now we'll explain you why we did all these things. So first, we want to have reproducible measurements, which is important. We want always to simultaneously calibrate the instrument and measure the Casimir force. So we don't want to calibrate first and then do the measurement afterwards, because it drifts in between or changes in settings, changes in alignment, change in whatever parameter might ruin your calibration. So we always want to do it simultaneously. We want to have an accurate knowledge of the surface separation. So instead of touching, what a lot of people do, we prefer to use the electrostatic force for that, because touching is prone to errors due to dust, due to spikes on your sample, due to a lot of other things. We need to compensate for residual electrostatic forces all the time. We want to eliminate drift problems, and we want to achieve a high precision with long integration times. So these are actually the things that we have implemented. And just to give you an impression, this is the setup. So this is a computer, a whole bunch of lock-in amplifiers, electronics, and the real system is inside this box. This is an acoustic chamber to damp all the sound waves so that we have no sound inside. When we open this, here we see together with my supervisor, Davide. When you look inside the acoustic chamber, we have here a system which is an active anti-vibration stage, and it is a plate where four piezos and four sensors are all the time monitoring the acceleration of the plates and compensating actively for the motion. Screwed on top of that is the AFM. And when we zoom in again, this is the AFM. Inside here, you have this cantilever and the sample and the sphere. The optical path is inside here. There are a lot of piezos, and everything is mounted on an aluminum block that is maintained at a constant temperature. So there's an active temperature regulation of the system to decrease the drifts. So a summary, we have an atomic force microscope with an optical lever readout. So it means when we use the optical path that changes and goes on the photodetector. We have a feedback-controlled, capacitively feedback-controlled piezoelectric stage, which means that we don't have creeps or hysteresis. There's a sensor inside the piezo so that you give a set point and it will go to there with a PID controller, maintain its position. And this guy is calibrated against traceable standards by the manufacturer. We have an active temperature stabilization of the AFM a few degrees above room temperature. We have active vibration isolation, passive sound isolation, and the whole setup is located in the basement in a temperature-controlled and humidity-controlled laboratory. So how do we calibrate this guy? As I said, we use the electrostatic force. Within the PFA, the proximity force approximation, the electrostatic force is given by this equation, where V0 is the residual potential. And it's typically ascribed to contact potentials, but well, it can also be something else. It is a experimental offset in the voltage, but the origin, I think, is not completely understood. Then how do we treat this, how do we use this force? Instead of applying a constant bias voltage that is typically done, we apply an oscillating bias voltage. So we have a DC component plus an oscillating component. And we do this at a certain frequency, namely 72 hertz, and this is quasi-static. And what I mean with this is when you compare it to the resonance frequency of the cantilever at 1.8 kilohertz, the cantilever can easily follow motions at 72 hertz. It will not pick up a phase shift. And the reason why we do this I have to explain. Most people work at the resonance frequency because they're the most sensitive. The problem is if you have a oscillator, then you have a sharp peak in the amplitude response around the resonance frequency. If now due to a temperature change or a force or whatever, your resonance frequency shifts a bit, then the amplitude response changes a lot. So in fact, if you do amplitude modulation like we are doing, you're very sensitive to little drifts in the resonance frequency. Now we are completely in the quasi-static tail where the amplitude response is completely flat. So if you have some drift in the resonance frequency, it doesn't matter. We always have the same amplitude response. That's the reason why we work there. But the system is sensitive enough also at the quasi-static limit. Then the signal we have on the photodetector is in principle a deflection, so a force divided by the spring constant, is Hooke's law, times some calibration factor, which is the sensitivity of the instrument, which is not known a priori. Then you can fill this in. So we substitute the voltage we apply into the equation, and then we get this equation. Okay, nice. And then we go to the next slide. And what we see here is that there is one component that is actually has the same frequency as the frequency that we pump the system with. This component, we want to make it zero. Because when you make it zero, actually you have a DC voltage that is exactly compensating for your residual voltage between your two surfaces. So what we do, we have a lock-in amplifier that is measuring all the time this component at omega, and then correcting the voltage to have this term zero. So effectively, you have always automatically compensated for the contact potential. Now, just a quick intermezzo, a lock-in amplifier. What is a lock-in amplifier? If you have a reference signal at some frequency and you have a sensor signal as a function of time, you put the two things, you put them in a black box, which is a lock-in amplifier, and this lock-in amplifier calculates two quantities. It computes the in-phase component, which is effectively just a inner product of your signal with a reference. So just gives you the in-phase component, the component at the frequency of the reference that is in-phase, and it gives you the out-of-phase component. And then you can also get the modulus of the vector and the angle. So effectively, it just gives you the signals that have the same frequency as the frequency you are using to modulate your system, and you check the in-phase and the out-of-phase components. Now, so by making this negative feedback loop at omega, we have canceled the contact potential. Well, we can check how well it works. This is a run for a specific sample as a function of distance on the horizontal axis between something like 60 or 70 nanometers to around 2 micron. Or 1 micron, and this is the voltage we have to apply to have no electrostatic force. So this is the compensating voltage, and you see here that there is a dependence on distance of around 2.5 millivolt over the entire range. So it works. This is a different sample. We also have some drift as a function of distance, and we also have some drift as a function of time, which is smaller than as a function of distance, but it also varies as a function of time. And this is actually for a measurement that is running now, where I mounted the sample and immediately started to measure. I mean, first experimentalists typically mount something and they wait for 1 or 2 days till everything is settled. But now I immediately started the measurement, and then you see actually when you mount it, this is around 2 days that you have to wait before this contact potential settles. Now, the origin of this effect, I don't know. I just want to show you that you have to be careful with this VDC. So you cannot simply assume that this is a constant due to the surfaces or due to the materials. This is an experimental constant that can vary by a large amount. Here we are talking about 80 millivolts, which is a lot.
It's as though the surface is kind of curing this.
Yeah, I mean, what is what could be an explanation? We work in air. We don't work in vacuum. We have a certain humidity in the air. In fact, when the sample is stored, it's stored simply at room temperature. When we go inside the box, the humidity is lower because there's a lot of silica gel and there's heating inside the box. So the humidity is lower, and you might slowly get rid of some humidity. And then when you settle to some equilibrium value.
Yeah, but what's the reason for the time dependence may be okay, but what is it about the distance dependence?
That's something else. I don't know.
You mentioned also 4 millivolt. Would some other people, I think Decca and Mordine...
They work in vacuum. I cannot compare my measurements to their measurements.
Yeah, but told us that they only accept certain, probes where VDC is...
Yeah, I accept every probe. I mean, I find it...
Yeah, but just to get a feeling. Mm-hmm. It's 4 millivolt. Is it big on wear scale? I mean, we have, of course, also...
No, and 4 millivolt is small. I mean, you will see in the end that my Casimir force results seem to be not influenced.
Okay.
But 80 millivolt would completely ruin the measurement.
Okay.
That is the order.
I have a question. If this contact potential depends on time, as it does, in the first equation where you do the convolution between your time-dependent cantilever, mm-hmm. right, and a constant, and a time-dependent...
Yeah, but this is hours, huh?
Okay, so
this is one. Yeah, this is 101 hour, and the other was goes at 72 hertz, so 70
okay.
times per second.
So
it's a completely different time scale.
But it's also very long.
Yeah, we're really talking about something like 50 hours to settle.
The obvious question is anything sticking on that surface from the air?
Yeah, it can perfectly be. So that's why I also say going to vacuum might improve these things. I mean, I cannot do these measurements in vacuum because I don't have a vacuum system. In air, I have this problem.
And if you take that surface after the measurement and you do sort of kind of...
Okay, that is a funny thing.
See what's there. Some Auger spectroscopy, something that says what's on the surface. What do you see?
That I don't know. The only thing what I can say, this sample was in before, in the setup. Then after a long equilibration time, I also had this same value. So then it is stored, then it's put back in the system, you go to some weird thing, but then the equilibrium position is again the same number. That's the only thing I can say.
If you do a very simple test, I know that our friends who work on such systems, put a drop of water,
mm-hmm.
which should be spreading very nicely on the gold surface. What does the drop do?
I wouldn't know. I mean, I'm planning to do measurements with different humidities in the box to see how the humidity influences.
No, I'm more interested just in using the drop as a probe of what's on the surface.
Yeah, I didn't do it. I could do it. But let me go on. Then there's also here a component that goes like with a double of the frequency. And we use another locking amplifier to measure this term. So there's a locking amplifier that is actually measuring the 2 omega term, where the peak-to-peak value of this thing that the locking is measuring should scale like this, where gamma is, again, the calibration of the photodetector, so not the permittivity of vacuum, R the radius of the sphere, K the spring constant, D the absolute separation, and V the voltage we're putting. And this whole thing, we call this thing alpha. And alpha is, in fact, measured by this number that comes out of the locking amplifier divided by the voltage square. And both things are measured. I mean, the voltage I put is a function generator. I know how much I put. And this is a number that comes out of the locking. So the measurement is measuring alpha. which is the curvature of the electrostatic parabola for people that have seen ways of talking about this. Then this prefactor, I call it kappa from now on, is the force calibration constant. D is the absolute separation. And then there's an extra thing. You see from this equation that if you go closer and closer, then the electrostatic force will become bigger and bigger. And we don't want to do that. So what we actually do is we scale down VAC in such a way to keep the force constant. So in a certain measurement, we always have the electrostatic force constant at a certain value, because otherwise it blows up. Then, according to this equation, this alpha should scale like 1 over the distance. So that we go to the next slide. And there's one thing I want to emphasize, is that with alpha, you characterize the voltage square behavior. So if there's some background force that does not depend on voltage, you don't see it in this experiment. You only see the terms that scale quadratic in the voltage. Any other background force is not measured in alpha. So this is a plot.
I have another question. Mm-hmm. So the range of a force, if you have it between a flat and a curved surface, the range of a force tells you how much of that curved surface you're actually sampling. The long-range force will see much more of the curved surface than a short-range force. If you're calibrating with a fairly long-range force, and you're going to measure a short-range force, does it matter that you're seeing different parts of the surface?
As long as your surface is homogeneous, it doesn't. But this V naught dependence on distance might indicate some inhomogeneity, and then there might be some problem. That is the answer. You can measure this alpha, so this parameter as a function of time. This is at 2 hours. I just move the piezo to one specific position, and I wait for 2 hours, and I'm continuously measuring the parameter alpha. Okay, you get a run, and then you can put a smooth curve through it, and you can check the deviation from the smooth curve. This is a Gaussian, and the spread of the Gaussian is 0.56%, which tells you that you can measure the value of alpha with an uncertainty of 0.56%. And when I say uncertainty or sigma or whatever, I always mean the sigma, the square root of the variance. I don't go to 95% or 99% confidence or whatever. This is just the standard deviation. So it's good that it's normally distributed and the error is relatively small. Another remark, the error is in principle, the relative error is constant over the whole measurement because the force is kept constant by this rescaling of the voltage. So I have a relative error that is constant over the whole regime. Okay, then the big problem of it... Sorry.
That you can go just at one. I mean, are you sure that you are not underestimating the error? I mean, because I would say, okay, what would do, I mean, you have this complicated time dependence that you don't understand. You are basically doing the analysis a posteriori. So you do it time by time.
Yes.
But for example, if I would consider this to be, assuming I say, okay, this should be a linear dependence, then if you redo the analysis, then you will get a much larger error.
Yeah, that's true. But this is, this is
a very conservative estimate yours, based on assumption that this is the true behavior. So you are doing fitting and determining.
Not fitting. You're smoothing in some way.
Yeah, it's somehow a fitting procedure.
Yeah, I mean, the error can vary a bit, but it cannot become 10%. Or it cannot become 0.1%.
0.1. Well, 0.1. I think maybe not. It's basically,
I think it's quite okay.
6. Well, if you look in perspective and you do the projection, if it doubles, I would be surprised.
Okay, I think it's quite okay this number. I mean, there's depends a bit on how you smooth, but it shouldn't matter that much.
Yeah, I mean, that's important. This is an error with some assumptions.
Yeah, this is an error with some assumptions. Then the problem is typically that you know how much you are moving, but you don't know at which position you started to move. So you don't know the absolute separation. You only know the relative change of separations. In the PFA, in the normal electrostatic way, this should scale like this calibration constant divided by the absolute separation, which is the starting separation minus how much I moved upwards. There was a recent paper on PRA by Kim and Onofrio that showed that there was a 0.7 in the parameter, so that this equation is not generally true. They found an alpha that was going in this direction with PH 0.7. So we thought, okay, we were gathering electrostatic data already for a year. So when we analyze our data, you see on the dashed line the 0.7 model and in the continuous line the P equal 1 model. And these are both the best fits you can do. The chi-square with the 0.7 is 411 and with P equal 1 is 1.21 using the error bar that was determined before. So I would say in our experiment at least, the 0.7 model is ruled out and we have a normal electrostatic scaling law, P equal 1.
Your chi-square, this is the reduced chi-square?
Reduced chi-square of the fit.
Well, I since I'm an author of the other paper, I should mention that they're completely different experiments because in our experiment, the sphere is huge.
Yeah, I mean... So, I mean, I'm not saying this in contradiction. I mean, that the experiment is wrong. I say in our experiment, we don't have this problem, for sure. So we can use safely the electrostatic force to calibrate our device.
Why should hugeness matter? You're making a huge sphere assumption all the time anyway.
Well, I mean...
In that sense, it shouldn't matter.
Yeah.
But you have more charge, you can have more trap charges, more other problems.
Trap charges, and also, in principle, you could also have local deviation from sphericity that could change exponent. We think it's not the case in the experiment, but that's another possibility.
So this 0.7 is... I'm not familiar with it. Is that something you've calculated?
There's a measurement.
It's coming out from the experiment.
If you have deviations from sphericity and you're calibrating with one range of forces and you're measuring the force of a different range, those deviations should show up in unexpected ways.
Well, I mean, this is always measuring electrostatics, right?
But then you're going to go measure something not like this.
Yeah, but this was not the goal of this experiment. But
let's at least say, I mean, in our experiment, everything is fine. We have no problems here. So we can find the absolute separation from this graph. Since this should diverge at separation zero, we use the divergence of this graph to fit. And this we call D0, the starting separation. This is on a log-log scale. These are 600 independent data sets, all fitted with the electrostatic data on a double logarithmic plot, and you see that they all follow a straight line with slope equal to 1. So there's no real deviation from the scaling law. Then I want to just to give you a number. The cantilever motion at this frequency that is probing the electrostatic force is 50 picometers, and we have an uncertainty of around 500 femtometer in the determination of the motion of the cantilever. That is with an 8 seconds integration time per point, and this is a relative error of around 1%, like the 0.5% I showed before. If you compare this, for example, to the experiment by Kim, they have a 4% error on this parameter with an 8 to 10 minutes integration time. So we are a factor of 60 more sensitive, or at least 240 times more precise. Then, since we are so precise, we have to be a bit careful, because in the analysis of the electrostatic data, we use the proximity force approximation. We have a sphere with a diameter of 200 micron. We measure from 2 micron separation and closer, but even then, we see that there is a systematic in the fit. So here, the dots are the systematics, so the residuals of the fit procedure, and you see that there is a systematic trend in that. In black, you see the expected residual when you fit a real electrostatic data from the full equation with the PFA, with this radius, and it matches more or less. So this is the systematic you see is due to the fact that we're using a PFA in electrostatic force that is within the precision of our experiment, not good enough anymore. And this is a PFA in electrostatics, not in Casimir. Okay, then I want to talk a bit about stability.
Which is the accuracy of your D naught, the measure on the best fit, and then the previous slide.
The uncertainty in D naught is around 0.4 nanometer. The kappa was the force calibration constant, is one of the two fit parameters in the electrostatic data. You see here over a run over 72 hours, you see that kappa is varying by less than 0.5%. over this time span. You can again do some smoothing to this curve and check the deviation, and it gives you an error of around 0.2% in this parameter. Then we can assess the other fit parameter, which is the D naught, the starting separation of the experiment. And you see that as a function of time, it drifts. So this is a mechanical drift that is due to the expansion of the setup. You have all steels, and the expansion depends on the temperature of the system. So even when we have stabilized everything, we still do have drifts, although they are small. In 72.5 hours, we have something in drift like 50 nanometers. That is around 0.1 nanometer per whole measurement run. So the drift within a measurement run, you can easily neglige it. Or 10 picometers per minute. If you compare to other groups, the Chevrier group in Grenoble has around 1 nanometer per minute. The experiment of Kim had around 60 nanometers per run, and we have less than 0.1 nanometer per run. So the drift is really much better. So we are at least 100 times more stable than other groups in the world in terms of distance. Then you can smooth this curve when you assume that that mechanical motion of a system are slow. I mean, this would be quite fascinating to see a 1 kilohertz motion of a system. So it's a slow drift, and then you can do again this deviation, and the deviation from the line gives you again a Gaussian with a spread of 0.45 nanometer. So this is an error in the determination of the starting position, and by that also an error in the determination of the absolute separation. This error is due to the random error in the parameter alpha that propagates to the uncertainty estimate of the fit. So you have, you're fitting something, but your data has errors, and those propagate into the estimate of D naught. And that is where this error comes from. So it's not a real mechanical error in the system, but it's an error in the fit procedure of the electrostatic force, and it's around 4.5 angstrom. So note here that the error on the distance is normally distributed. I think I'm the first one ever to show in this kind of experiments how the error on the distance is distributed. I mean, the error is sometimes quoted or not, but at least it's not shown how it is distributed. Then we have another parameter in the system, which is the spring constant. Why do we want to know the spring constant? Because anyway, we calibrate with a force, we want to measure a force. Why do you want to know the spring constant? Well, what you do want to know, you want to know if you apply a force, or if the Casimir force is there, how much your cantilever bends and thereby changes the distance. So if you have a very stiff spring, the distance will not change, so it's fine. If you have a very soft spring, the distance will change a lot. You have to correct your distance axis for the actual bending of the cantilever. You could think, do we have already this number? Because we had kappa and R, we can measure it, and I mean, what can we do? But the problem is that gamma, which is the calibration of the photodetector, is not known. So you cannot use this equation yet. You have to do something extra to get the spring constant. So we designed a new method to actually use the fact that the force changes the separation to measure the spring constant. And I will explain you what I mean with this. So we go back to this equation of the electrostatic force. I write again this equation. Now, since V naught is compensated all the time, we can forget it. I mean, it's automatically compensated, so we can just talk about voltage. That's the net voltage I'm applying. Now, this is what you typically write, but in fact, and this is the real distance, but the real distance is the distance you think you are putting minus the amount the cantilever is actually bending. So you have to solve this equation, F equals this one. You have to solve it. And then you get a new equation for the force, which is like this. Okay, is an equation. Then you have to remember that actually the signal you are measuring is again the volt of the force divided by the spring constant, so it's a deflection times the calibration. You can put it in, and you can take a Taylor expansion, and then you have these terms. So I take the Taylor expansion up to fourth order. Then we plug again in that we have this voltage, and then you get this total equation for the signal, and you have, I mean, it will go through step by step, you have here two terms that are not depending on time, so these are static terms. Then you have one term here that varies with 2 omega, which is the alpha term that we used for the electrostatic force. Then you have here another term at 2 omega, and you have a term at 4 omega. So by taking this into account, we have also an extra harmonic at four times the pump frequency. Now, as I told you, gamma is unknown, but as you can see, all terms here are linear in gamma. So if we take the ratio of two terms, gamma drops out. Luckily, the spring constant does not drop out. Otherwise, we would have had nothing. But if you take the ratio of two of those terms, then you can find kappa by n because gamma is canceled from the thing. So that is, this 4 omega is where, again, a lock-in amplifier comes in that this is measuring at four times the pump frequency. Does it work? Well, it does work. Here I plot as a function of distance the fourth order over the second order. That should scale like epsilon naught pi radius over k times the distance square. You see here that this is a fit with a slope of minus 2 on a log-log scale. The spring constant you obtain with this fit is 1.1 newton per meter. The manufacturer that supplied the cantilevers quoted a number of 0.9 newton per meter, which is reasonably close. And we coated, when we glue the sphere, we coat it with gold so that ours is a bit stiffer than quoted by the manufacturer is okay. We don't have to know this number very precise because around 1 newton per meter is so stiff that the cantilever is effectively not bending in a static way. I mean, the maximum force you're going to have is a nanonewton, which will correspond to a nanometer. So you will have during the total measurement run, you will maximum have a deflection of 1 nanometer, and this you can safely neglect on the scale of the experiment. What I want to tell you here is that here I don't have a motion of 50 picometer. I put more electrostatic force, so I have a motion of the cantilever of around 2 nanometer, which is in fact surprising that you can measure this curve, because for example here you are at a few hundred nanometer and you are looking at the change in the signal due to the fact that the cantilever is moving 2 nanometers. So it's changing this few hundred nanometers by 2 nanometers, and that is the whole signal I'm plotting here. And fits quite nicely with the slope you expect. So now what? We know the absolute separation. We know the force calibration constant. We know the spring constant. So we should measure the force. I mean, we have complete knowledge of everything. Now there's a problem. We have this nice stiff spring constant that doesn't change the separation much. But if you have a high spring constant, you're also not really sensitive. So this is too small to detect accurately. I want to show you something. This is this static deflection of the cantilever, so just seeing how much it is bending, and then convert it into force for something like 200 independent runs. And you would say, okay, the noise is high, but still I have, the black line is the average, still I have some force. What most people in the AFM community are forgetting is that when you zoom out a bit, it actually looks like this, the signal. And you see here that is actually not constant.
It's the Casimir force?
This is the Casimir force.
Okay.
Yeah.
Residual force.
This is the residual force. It is the force that is left over. And you see that this signal, I mean, it's not even the force, it's the signal that is left over, which is something different. What you see here is that there's a background, which is not constant, and somehow you have to deal with that. I don't know how. Most people simply take the data from here to here, take a straight line, and subtract it from all data, and then hope that everything is fine. I think there's no proof for why this should be linear, if it should also still be linear in this regime. I mean, it's tricky. Then, as I said, the force noise is quite high, and that is due because this 5 on the axis means 500 piconewton, which with a spring constant of around 1 newton per meter would be 5 angstrom. So you're looking here at a total signal of 5 angstrom, which is very small. So we have to find a trick. And what we do is we modulate the position of the plate. So we have our cantilever, we have our sphere, we have the plate below. We change the separation, but on top of that, we're going to slightly modulate the position of the plate. So we're going to oscillate the plate position. We do that at a new frequency, at 119 hertz, which does not overlap with the other frequencies. And okay, with a sine shape. The amplitude and the phase of this motion are calibrated with a fiber optic interferometer, and this is an important point, because what you could say, okay, I have my piezo and I just put a function generator at 119 hertz and gives the sine and it should move. But the piezo is a mechanical system with a mass, so it will not react instantaneously on the voltage you apply. So your piezo will pick up a phase with respect to the pump you put. So that is why we align the whole system really with an optic, with a fiber optic interferometer, to really align the system to the actual motion of the plate and not to the reference signal. So everything is aligned really to the motion. Then the amplitude of this motion is around 4 nanometer with an error of 2%, which is due to the error in the fiber optic readout.
So actually, you're doing a measurement of the force.
Yeah, this is something I want to this is what I'm going to tell you now. It's completely different than how DECA is doing the measurement. DECA also modulates the position, but then checks the resonance frequency and checks the change of resonance frequency. We are in air. In air, the resonance frequency is very broad due to damping, so you cannot track the resonance frequency. So we do something else. We work again at 119 hertz, which is way below the 1.8 kilohertz. So we're again in a static measurement. And I wanted to draw this thing, I think, because it's the easiest. So what we do, and I hope you guys can see it, is our light work. Wow. So if you have some signal as a function of distance, and is in this way probably a signal like this, then when you modulate the distance, if you are here and you modulate a certain amount, then the signal you will see is very small. As you go from this point to this point to this point to this point. If you do it here, by the same amount, you will actually get a much bigger signal. So what you're effectively, you're measuring the local slope averaged over this amount. So it's still a static measurement. But we call it quasi-static because it is at a certain frequency. But the frequency is so low that the cantilever is just reacting in a static way. Okay. So that is what we measure. So we measure the change of signal, the derivative of the signal, times the amount of change we put. Now, we have to remember that the signal is given by this equation. So in fact, we're indirectly also we're probing the derivative of the force. So in that sense, it's the same as a dynamic measurement, but we do it in a static way and not by the resonance frequency. So we don't have any problems with drift. So that is the main reason to work in the static regime. So then we want to check this. First, we wanted to check it with an electrostatic force because that is the force we know. I mean, we have calibrated the system with it, everything scaled properly. We know it very precisely, so we first check whether it works. This is, again, the full equation of the signal. Now, these omegas, where the omegas was 72 hertz. And now we are looking at 119 hertz. And at 119 hertz, you don't see those terms because they average out to zero. So the time average of those three components is zero when you look at the frequency that is different than this omega. So those terms are out in the modulation force. You do have two other terms that are static that do not average out. They're just there. This term is extremely small, so you can typically neglect it. So you end up with this only this term and then so this equation. So we have a change of signal that should scale like this. Well, we can check that. Here, as a function of distance, I plot the derivative signal that is measured with this modulation of the plate. In blue, you have the data. In red is the calculated derivative of the force you expect without any fit parameter. So this is just using the calibration we did simultaneously to calculate what you expect to have. Note here that the slope is 1 or minus 1, which might seem strange because the electrostatic force scales like 1 over the distance, so the derivative should scale like 1 over the distance square. So why is that? Now, I actually also told you that we keep the force constant. So we scale down, we keep the voltage square over the distance constant to have the force constant, and if you do that, then of course the derivative scales like 1 over the distance. So that's why we see a slope 1. Okay, now we come to the Casimir force. This is the Casimir force signal. So now we have only a very small electrostatic force to compensate for the V naught and to do the calibration of the distance and of the force. So here in blue, you see the residual electrostatic derivative force that is there due to the calibration. And in black, you see the data, and in red, you see a theoretical model for the interaction between two gold surfaces. This is a simple model, and this is just Pollock data with a Drude model, zero temperature, no surface roughness. So it's just to show that we're in the right order of magnitude. So again, there are no fit parameters. Huh? The whole system is calibrated with electrostatic force. What you get is really Newton per meter square. Note here that I always say 1 over the radius. Why do I do that? Within the proximity force approximation, the electrostatic force is given by this equation, Casimir force by this one, derivative of the Casimir force by this, and they all are linear in the radius of the sphere. So it's actually better to always talk about force over radius and derivative of force over radius, because then the radius of the sphere doesn't matter. So within the PFA, the radius of the sphere does not come into play at all, ever. So you also don't have to measure it with an SEM.
So basically what you are measuring here is the force between two plane plates at the end.
If the PFA holds, yes.
Do you have by any chance the exponent of the counterforce?
Yeah, okay, but
we'll come later.
Since you are using the proximity force approximation which connect the forward to the plate configuration.
Yeah, but you're still measuring a derivative of force. That is what you measure. You can decide to interpret it as a parallel plate pressure, but it's not what you measure. Now there's a problem. So far I typically only talked about random errors. There's a systematic error now. I showed you the residuals of the electrostatic fit. The residuals of the electrostatic fit were not random, so we had a residual with a systematic, so we had a problem there. And from that, you actually have a misfit of the separation distance. So although we have this very small residual, you can calculate that the error in the distance you have is around 1.4 nanometer due to the use of the PFA in the electrostatics. I write plus or minus 0.1 if you assume that you know your radius within 10%, which is very reasonable with an SEM. So what I did, I just shifted all the data 1.4 nanometer away to correct for this systematic problem. On the other hand, as I showed you in the previous graph, there is an electrostatic background, and I also subtracted that one. It's a very small one, but I have to subtract it here, because it's always there, because the calibration is always on, so we always have this background. But it's a small background, and it's a very, very well-known background. With an error of less than 1% is known, so the error you make by the subtraction is very small. You can also plot it double logarithmic, and this is between 60 and a little bit more than 200 nanometer. The derivative of the force in red is the theory. You see that close by, the theory and the data do not match, which is probably due to surface roughness. The sphere has a certain roughness which is not included in the theory here. And there's another problem that far away it also doesn't match. Now this is, I think, is due to this background light effect. So when you're far away, the point is that you have some background in the force, so the derivative has some constant. So instead of going to zero, it goes to some constant value. And that is a problem of all AFM measurements. So what you can do is you can plot it Lin-Lin scale like this, and then go very far away, and then check how much it is. Assume it's constant. It's the same as assuming that it's linear in the force. Subtract that one, and then see what your slope is going to do. But I don't want to do it right now, because I don't really know how I should correct for this signal. So this is the background light. These are again 600 independent data sets, by the way. So these are 600 times measured, one after the other.
Your fingers show us where you feel comfortable.
Well, comfortable about the data?
That it doesn't.
From the data, I'm comfortable around more or less here.
Yeah. Okay.
So up till here, I think the data is correct. But the theory here is not correct, because it didn't take any surface roughness into account.
Right, so where would that be? Just put your hands between where we should be worrying and not worrying about the red line being different from the dots.
I think you have to worry everywhere.
Now, Sven, you didn't take into account this possible effect of the V not dependent on distance on the residuals, right?
No.
So
I did not. So that might play here. Also, here it cannot play, because the electrostatic force is so small And this residual thing is presumably even smaller. I mean, and I also had runs where the distance dependent of V0 was not there. And then they show exactly the same data. So presumably it's due to the fact that I'm so close, that it doesn't matter that much. My spheres are small, the capacitance are much smaller than in the experiments of Lamoureux and Onofrio. So I think that's why I don't see this effect. But, I mean, yeah, we have to talk about it. There might be something. But I would say in this experiment, this is typically simply due to scattered light, that light that scatters into the photodetector. So you cannot really say anything here.
The red light has slope of 3, roughly. This is the...
No, I think much higher.
No? 3 divided by 1.
Yeah, it should be a bit higher, because it's the derivative of the force. So I would expect something like 3.5 for gold in this regime. It's around 3.5. The force scale is like 2.5.
It's in the non-retarded regime.
No, it's in the retarded regime. I mean, we're between 70 nanometer and further away, which is retarded. I mean, the bending to van der Waals should occur somewhere here. And this is still in the Casimir part. This is the Casimir. I mean, it's not the van der Waals force. It's a Casimir force. When we talk about it.
But it's 3 orders of magnitude on the left and 1 order on the right. So that, to me, is 3 divided by 1 is 3.
I mean, I don't know how you do it, but the slope of this line is 3.5. That's it. Sorry. I'm happy to discuss, but...
Could it be 3.7 also?
No, it cannot be 3.7.
No, why do you say 3.5?
Okay, 3.5 plus or minus 0.05, I don't know.
You draw the line, what do you want from them?
I mean, if you draw a line with a slope 3.5, then it runs parallel here.
Yeah, so
but it's not strictly 3.5, it's not a strict power law.
We are not in the advanced regime, not in the fully retarded regime.
Yeah, because I have real materials. I mean, real materials do not have a slope of 4. So I'm in between, which is normal.
But the funny thing is, Decker, he has a slope of 3.7, and Hoskotter, I all the time mix up.
Palazanzas?
Yeah, he has also a slope of 3.7.
Yeah, I mean...
In what distance?
But, I mean, on Decker's experiment, I cannot comment, but on Palazanzas' experiment, I can put a comment. And he's using the same AFM head, so it's the same laser, the same detector, the same thing. So he also has this background, like I have. Now, you have to subtract it in some way to fit a nice power law.
Okay.
And I don't know how sensitive the slope is to how you subtract that number.
But why would the background light depend on D at all?
Okay.
Looking at DF to DD.
No. The point... No. Okay. Now I'm changing the position of the piezo. Huh? So when I mean, at the beginning, I showed Pohr's Versten's motion of the piezo, and it looks something like this. When you're here and you're modulating, your signal has a derivative. So you measure this derivative anyway when you're far away. So you have an offset also in the derivative. Now, you can say, okay, when you assume it's linear, then it's the same as assuming there is constant, and you have to subtract something from the whole curve. Then there is a question, is it really linear? Because there is a problem. You have the sphere and the plate. I would say, I mean, people typically say it's light that goes on your sample in the detector, but geometrically that doesn't work. So it must be something light that scatters from the cantilever, diffracts, and then goes into your detector. And then it's much more logical that it's in fact a function of the distance and not a function of how much your piezo is moving. And when you're doing this curve right here, the cantilever is bending. So you're mixing your signals all the time. So it's tricky.
Just a second. When you say theory, I mean, the theory you have no uncertainty like in the knowledge of material dependent parameters.
I'm not comparing. This is not a rigorous comparison with theory. This is just to show that what the theory looks like. I mean, it is not our goal to make a very precise comparison with theory. The goal is to show the dependence on dielectric properties.
It's actually only the slope of a theory fitted, or
no, the theory is not. There's nothing fitted here.
No, but well,
there are no fits.
No, but my problem is the theory. How seriously should I take this curve?
Well, I mean, according to the to Paula's answers, not really.
No, but I mean, when you know, I mean, for the calculation, you need the whole spectrum.
Yeah, okay, but it's a few percent. That we're on a log-log scale. I mean, a few percent. I mean, is not really much on this scale. I mean, to give you an idea, the scattering of the data points is around 5%. So the theory scatters as much as the. The uncertainty in the theory is as broad as the scattering in the data points, more or less.
As broad as in the your experiment, okay.
So this, if this theory curve you were to expand and include over one order of magnitude on this side and on the other side, although you don't have the data, wouldn't it curve in the opposite direction?
Sorry?
You have to go from slope of 3 to slope of...
Okay, but this is not a force. Huh? I mean, this is a background thing. This is an artifact. This has nothing to do with force. This is due to the fact that you use an atomic force microscope. It has nothing to do with force. This is not a force. This is a systematic problem in the measurement.
Let's hear you saying that nothing to do with the Casimir force.
No, this has nothing to do with the Casimir force. Does not even have to do anything with a force. Is due to some light that is scattered into a detector, which has nothing to do with a physical force. It's an artifact of an AFM. And I had a discussion with the head of the R&D department of Vico Instruments, which is the biggest manufacturer of atomic force microscopes in the world. They have the same problem, and he told me that if I know how to fix it, they would be extremely happy to know. So it's not a problem that only I have in my setup. All atomic force microscopes have this problem.
Where's the light coming from?
And it's the light that you use to detect the position of the cantilever.
Okay.
But it, boom. The point is that the diameter of the laser laser beam is not smaller than the dimension of the cantilever. So it's effectively diffracting from your cantilever. Then reaches the sample is metallic, reflects back, goes into your photodetector via God knows which path, and then gives some signal.
But by tweaking with the intensity of the light you use to measure, you can shift this around.
All the AFMs are always normalized with respect to the intensity of light, because otherwise jittering in the laser would increase the noise a lot. So the intensity is already canceled out.
What about making a smaller spot?
That would be a very good idea, but it's very difficult. The space that is accessible is when we tried to play, but it's and you make yourself your life very hard, because if you have a very small spot, it's extremely difficult to align the system to get your cantilever exactly in the spot where you can do the alignment, and so it's difficult.
The question about the other side short separations.
Yes.
It seems to me that the deviation between this the red line and the data, it's hard to tell, but it seems like almost 30% at the shortest separation.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, could that. So is this consistent with the surface roughness you have? I mean, just as a rough estimate. So
I cannot give this estimate because I did not measure the roughness of this sphere. That is because the system is actually still running, as we speak now, is measuring all the time, gathering higher and higher statistics, and also checking other samples with the same sphere, so I know I have the same surface roughness, and when all the measurements are finished, I will take the sphere out and measure the roughness. But I won't do it in between, because then I might damage the sphere, and then... So I will give... I mean, when I do the measurement, it's freely available to have the roughness of the sphere.
Are you going to measure the complete roughness spectrum, or just the variance?
No, I'm going to measure with an AFM the roughness of the sphere. So
what do you mean exactly to measure?
The topography.
What?
The topography. Okay, so the height on the whole, on the thing.
With that you can calculate the spectrum, right?
Yes.
Just to build up Torsten's comment. So there's an effective surface that you used in the electrostatics.
Yes.
And that had whatever the roughness was.
It's some averaged in an electrostatic way.
So, and this is averaged in a, I don't know, Casimir way,
yes.
Which is politically correct language. Okay, so, just to follow up on Torsten's point, what if you said, gosh, maybe I should just add something to say I'm really at another place? How much would you have to add, and how much would it change the way that bent on log-log paper?
Yeah, I think you should first then make the theory incorporate the roughness.
Nothing intellectual, no. Just change D by an additive amount because you had an assumption built in.
You mean how to get this data here? It would be a 10 nanometer.
Add 10. Right,
would be 10 nanometer, but you need to know the roughness to know whether this 10 nanometer makes sense.
Actually, you need to know the roughness to do what you're doing at all. So just if you say, I don't know the roughness, but I'm going to fix it this way, how much, I think that's the spirit of Toshi's comment.
My attitude would be to use...
But with the curvature go away, that's your point, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay, I would say if you want to make a precision comparison between data and theory using electrostatic force or any other calibration of the distance also touching, you should use a sphere with a roughness that is extremely small compared to the range you're in. So I would say this sphere is probably too rough to make a precision comparison between the data and the theory. So I would prefer for the precision, for a comparison, to use a sphere with a very smooth surface and use that one. I think this is... Because it's also not completely clear how the electrostatic force is influenced by the roughness. I mean, when you calculate the electrostatic force, you assume a perfect sphere and a perfect plate. And that's what you use. So you should be as close as possible to that thing if you want to use it. So, I mean, it's really not my goal here to compare on a precise level with theory. It's just to show that, and presumably the calibration is quite okay because this is the right order of magnitude. Then I want to say something about the stability. So let's look at one of those distances as a function of time. Is again for the 72 hours. And you see that the force or the derivative of the force at 67 nanometer is quite constant. I mean, you don't, by eye, you don't see any drift. So I said, okay, let's just take the average. That is the red line. And you can again plot or then measure the deviation from the point with respect to the line. And that is again a Gaussian, with a spread of 4.7%. This means that the random error on a measurement of the derivative of the force at a single point is 4.7% at this distance. So if you start to average, and for me it's relatively easy to average, for example, 1,000 runs, then you would end up with a random error easily below the 1% level. This is the random error, not the systematic error. Well, you can also do it at another distance, this morning at 97 nanometer, a bit farther away. Actually, although the derivative of the force is smaller, the spread is also smaller, which is in some sense strange because you're measuring a smaller force with the same sensitivity. But it's because here the uncertainty in the distance is less important because you're more far away. So that is why here the error is a bit smaller. So, I mean, there's some optimum. When you go even further away, then the error in the force is relatively too high, and then you don't gain anything by going further away. So I want now to make a comment on error analysis. And that is that other groups, and I mean, typically all other groups, they assume that the errors are normally distributed. And then by using a student's t-test, they estimate the size of the error. So it's assuming something and then estimating the error. So if somebody says it's a 1% error, this is an estimate, assuming that it was normally distributed, which was not measured. We have a completely different approach. We measure the size of the error and the distribution of the error, and then we do the analysis. It's a completely different way of doing it.
But I mean, your statement that this is normal, I mean, is based on viewpoints. Could be any other distribution which looks Gaussian.
I mean, not really a few points. I mean, we're talking about statistics of more than 600 data points, huh?
Yeah, but I can provide you a list of thousands of distribution which looks like as Gaussian as this one in this range, but they are completely different data.
But then the data analysis is then is not influenced. I mean, if you have a different mathematical distribution that gives the same shape, then also for the data analysis doesn't matter. Then there's some other thing that we discovered in the meantime. We're in air and not in vacuum. And air has a viscosity. And you have a sphere that is moving and you have a plate that is moving. So what does this thing? So there is a a expression for the hydrodynamic force when for a sphere with respect to a plate when the distance is much smaller than the radius, which is given by this equation where eta is the viscosity, v is the speed or the velocity, r is the radius of the sphere, and d is the absolute separation. And here's a big advantage of our system. That is, in fact, because we are modulating the position of the plate with a sine, that the speed goes with the cosine, because it's derivative of the position. And this is 90 degrees phase shifted with respect to the motion.
But that is a quasi-static force, right? Which here now I'm not sure your 72 hertz is...
No, me neither. I mean,
what's the speed?
There's an acceleration. The speed of sound would give 3 meters of wavelength, and we're at a few microns. So that's not a problem in air. So I would say, I would at first tend to believe that it holds. For sure, it scales with the velocity. So it will always be 90 degrees phase shifted with respect to the pump, which is very cool. Because you have one lock-in amplifier that was looking at this 119 hertz that was modulating the plate, has two signals, the in-phase and the out-of-phase component. The in-phase component gives you the Casimir force, the out-of-phase component gives you the hydrodynamic force. And they're completely separated. So you can measure them independently. So this is a measurement of the... So also simultaneous, in the same 600 runs, you see here the hydrodynamic force divided by the radius as a function of the distance. It blows up, like you would expect from a 1 over d. In fact, on the double logarithmic plot, you see some non-straightness. I also did some measurements that go a bigger distance and with more velocities, and then you see that there is a kink in this rule, where in this line, where far away it scales like 1 over the distance, but close by it does not. It scales with a weaker exponent. We do not understand yet why. So that we have to understand. But now, again, I want to make a comment. First, these forces are not small. With a radius of 10 to the minus 4 meter that I have, you have here a force of 50 piconewton, which is comparable to the Casimir force. So if you do a measurement in air, you cannot forget this hydrodynamic force when you have a hydrodynamic force. And there's the group of Palazansas also works in air, and they actually move pretty fast because they do a measurement run in half a second to have no problems with thermal drifts. But if you go half a second, you have quite some speed. And then you will have a hydrodynamic force in all your data that is not constant, but actually goes something like 1 over the distance, which is also in your force data. And because we use a modulation technique, we have the advantage that it goes into a separate signal, and we don't see it in the Casimir force. But if you would not modulate and would just go up and down like normal, then you do have also the hydrodynamic force into your equation, or into your residual force. So yeah, I don't know how you should take that into account, but I think you should for sure not neglect the hydrodynamic force when you measure at ambient pressure.
So the point of the non-linearity in the upper right is that it's less than you would have predicted by extrapolating.
Yeah, here it scales weaker than 1 over the distance.
So is that somehow indicating roughness or some kind of
a might be
boundary condition, something like that?
Might be. So I will try with different roughnesses. On the other end, it's quite strange that already above, at the 100 nanometer, it starts to bend. While in Casimir, I can go for sure down to 50 nanometers. So
I don't understand why it should depend on the roughness, because this hydrodynamic force is connected with the density of air.
Yeah, but the hydrodynamic force is derived in the laminar flow.
It's friction, yeah. It's
a laminar flow, and if you have roughness, then you might have turbulence and other effects there. So roughness can influence that thing. Okay, also to show you the drift in the hydrodynamic force over this 72 hours, we have a small drift, which is funny because it was not present in the Casimir signal. In fact, when you measure over longer times, you see that there are some drifts in this signal. We also don't know to what is related. The temperature in the system is constant. The humidity is constant. Air pressure is not, because it's determined by the real air pressure. We see drifts in the order of a few percent. The air pressure also changes a few percent, but the viscosity of air should not depend on the pressure, so I don't know.
Probably it's the humidity generated by the sample, because the sample is treated. We have seen that the V naught is drifting with over the time because.
Yeah, but this is not a, this can go down and then go up again and go down and go up again on the order of days.
Okay.
So it's a very small signal, and then it changes a few percent, but I don't know why. We don't know why.
What is actual temperature you're experiencing?
26 degrees Celsius, and the humidity is 29% relative humidity.
It's a very dry basement.
Well, the basement is, yeah, it's not that dry. There's actually water in the basement, but we put a lot of silica gel inside, and that helps. So then going back to the motivation at the beginning, can we now observe the switchable mirror? I didn't do it yet. Gold is still in the system, but as soon as I'm back in the Netherlands, I will start this experiment. I would say the random error we have now is around 4% on a single measurement. We can do a lot of statistics, so the error on the average can go down a lot. You expect a signal on the order of 20%, so it should be no problem. So, should be. But, I mean, they can always, I mean, the thing where we are afraid of is that you change from a conductor to an insulator, you create trap charges, your electrostatic force doesn't work anymore, your oil calibration is gone, and you're nowhere. So, the first thing that I will do is I will make just the mirrors and load them externally, so that they're hydrogenated, they're dielectric, then put them in and see if the measurement still works. If it does work, then I will make a system to be able to switch the Casimir force back and forth. Conclusions. Well, for sure we have reproducible data. I mean, we can have hundreds of curves on top of each other without any problem. By that, we have the possibility to accumulate high statistics. The system is, in fact, is completely, the whole data acquisition is governed by a computer. There's a computer in the basement with a LabVIEW software that is automatically all the time starting new measurement runs, fitting the D0 parameters, putting the new distance in where to start the measurement to account for the drifts. Everything is completely automatic. I don't have to do anything. So I just push start, and then it goes for weeks. Every 6 minutes as a data set. Well, I have to build a new setup now in the meantime. Another bonus is we can investigate the hydrodynamic force in air, and in an independent way from the Casimir force. So we can also try to investigate the strange scaling as a function of roughness, these things. And a special thing is that all errors are under control and normally distributed. More or less normally distributed. Enough normally distributed.
Okay, reasonably.
But not estimated, but experimentally determined. I mean, the distribution is measured and not estimated a posteriori. What's next? So we will perform Casimir force measurements of materials with various dielectric properties, including the switchable mirror, but presumably not limited to. We will investigate an in-situ change of the Casimir force with the switchable mirror. And in separately, while the system is measuring, I will start to build a vacuum-compatible setup to increase the force resolution, maybe also to understand what this V0 is doing as a function of time, to see if then maybe it's constant in time and at distance, maybe it's due to some contamination, all these kind of things. For that, we have a new sensor. So I quickly want to explain what it is. This is a single-mode optical fiber. So it's fused silica, a diameter of 125 micron. Where the inner 5 or 6 micron is a doped material, a doped silica, and light is guided through the optical fiber, and the light travels only in the core. So it doesn't travel in the cladding; it only travels through the core. Then, with a focused ion beam machine, we machine this cantilever out of the fiber itself. So we carve away, we shoot away material, to end up with a cantilever-based system. And this system here is a torsional system where we have a torsional rod to reduce the spring constant. So here is it will rotate instead of having to bend. So we expect a smaller, we expect a relatively small spring constant. This is another picture from a different angle here. You can actually see that you can look underneath. Here is the cantilever. The detection of the bending of the cantilever is done in a very convenient way. You simply, the optical fiber, when you can make it kilometers long, you plug it into an optical interferometer, which is just a laser, a coupler, and a detector. And then the light travels into the fiber, it is reflected from the fiber to air interface, which is underneath the cantilever. 4% of the light goes back. Then the rest of the light hits the cantilever and then is reflected back into the fiber. Those two signals interfere, and whether they interfere constructively or destructively depends on the position of the cantilever. And it is known, and I mean, we also see that you can determine the actual motion of the cantilever with subangstrom precision. And has a few advantages, this guy, and apart from that it's very small.
You can basically see the Brownian motion of the cantilever.
Yeah, but also now all the Gaussians you saw today are also due to Brownian motion. That's why they're Gaussian. The readout is aligned by construction. You don't have to align a laser, whatever. It's automatically there. You just put the fiber. The mechanical stability is extremely high. I mean, there are no moving components. The gap is extremely small, so you don't have a mechanical loop that can drift or whatever. It's a few micron gap, that's it. It's suitable for vacuum. Maybe we can just put it in vacuum. Also low temperature, no problem. And you have no background signal, because there is no light scattering from the cantilever going somewhere or whatever, because all the light is blocked by the cantilever by the construction of the device. So we're developing a vacuum Casimir 4 setup based on this sensor. These are my collaborators, and I want to thank you for your attention.
In the end, I didn't understand. I'm confused about this. How do you use this new?
Okay, it will.
With this sphere, I mean, you have to.
So we will glue a sphere here, like we glue now a sphere to a cantilever. I mean, this is more or less the same dimension as we are used to. So you just put some glue here, and then you put a sphere, and then you come with your plate here, and then we'll check how much it bends. So you just replace the AFM head with the problems it has with this guy, and the rest of the system can stay the same. Except that you also have to want to move to vacuum. And the method will be exactly the same. It's just plug and play. Instead of putting the photodetector to all the lock-in amplifiers, you put the interferometer output to all the lock-in amplifiers, and that is the only thing you change.
Hydrodynamic force you were talking about, it's friction. It's dissipative force. You
yes.
Might have all, because you have dynamical experiment and static, it doesn't exist. But you might have also Casimir frictions, which just because the fluctuation also depends on mutual motion of the device. But I think this would be extremely small.
I don't think you see them. I go very slow. Huh? I mean, on the time scale, this system is extremely slow. So, in fact, the only way, the reason why you modulate, the main reason is that you, and there are a few things, you get rid of all the drifts, because if there is some change of your signal that is not phase synchronous to your pump, you don't see it. So all the drifts are gone. Then there's another thing. If you just look at the static deflection of your cantilever, it is noisy because it's moving and so on. But if you have an harmonic oscillator, you have a resonance frequency, and the Brownian motion will mainly excite the resonance frequencies the frequencies close to the resonance frequency. If you go quasi-static, the Brownian motion is almost not there, and that's why we have only five and a few femtometer of motion of error on the parameters. So that is the And then by the lock-in, you look at such a very narrow frequency band that you only have the noise coming into your experiment that is located around this very narrow frequency band, instead of looking at all the noise at all frequencies.
What do you anticipate is the accurate working range of distances?
For this experiment?
Did you finally come to?
I would say that depends a lot on the spring constant. So you can, by going with a weaker spring constant, you can go farther away. With a stiffer spring constant, you could even go closer. If you want, I mean, my statement is, if you want to compare with theory, I think you should take a smoother sphere.
Right, that became clear. But again, what's the actual range of distances that you anticipate you'd be able to have data that you would...
With the AFM like is now.
Well, whatever your plan is also, I'm just curious what... I mean, the whole thing here is over what range you're measuring, what to expect.
Yeah, I mean, I would say from I mean, going down to 10 nanometers, no problem.
Down to 10 nanometers.
And going up, depends a bit on how bad this big background signal is. And that becomes the dominant problem.
And 10 nanometers, you're not going to worry about the roughness.
No, because, well, okay. If you have a very smooth, I mean, Palos Anzas has a nice paper on Langmuir, where he examined all the surface roughness of spheres. Yeah. And there is one special batch of spheres from a certain company that have, according to them, a very smooth surface. I also check them with SEM myself, and they look indeed very smooth.
Smooth means?
Smooth means smaller than a nanometer roughness, RMS.
So the lower bound one could expect is 10 nanometers? And
yes.
And you would work out, your springs work out to
where? Yeah, and then I would say the high distance limit is just determined by their spring constant.
And what would that be? I don't have an intuition.
Okay, right now I'm using a spring of 1 newton per meter.
Right.
I have springs of 0.01 newton per meter. So you can gain 2 orders of magnitude in the spring constant, which would gain you 2 orders of magnitude in the force, which then with a 3, more or less 3, would give you something like 2. So 0.7 order in the distance. So you go from 1 to 700 nanometer, maybe.
700 nanometers.
Yeah, I would say you can go up to 500, safely 500 nanometer with a soft spring. If everything works out, because there are problems with soft springs. That's why we use a stiff spring. And that is another thing that is typically not considered in AFM. I have to draw again something. It's also a funny thing to know for people who are not familiar with AFM. So you have a cantilever, and you glue to somehow your sphere. Now the fact is, what are you effectively measuring? What people say is, when you put a force, it will deflect a bit, and you measure this deflection. But it's not what is going on. Actually, this thing is bending, and you're looking at the change of angle here. So you go from this angle to this angle, and this change of angle gives you a force. And because the angle is very small, the sine of the angle is more or less the angle, and it works out. Now, when you go close, or when you go far away, or when you have soft springs, is more a problem. For example, when you touch, when you push up, you might also induce a torque here on your sphere, because this thing is under an angle. It's not parallel to your surface. It's under an angle. So in fact, while you're pushing up, this thing wants to go more like this, but you're also inducing a torque which makes the end bend like this, and this is actually the point where your laser is shining. So you think that in fact your sphere is going down instead of up, and that is also what I saw. So that is, and this is much more severe with soft springs, because then the roughness can produce the torque. If you have a very stiff spring, it will slide anyway. Okay. So
you can see this from the power law, at least, I guess. When if you're attaching, probably you're thinking that you're still far away from the plate, there should be a change in, at least in the power law and the force you're measuring, I guess. Please.
I don't know. I mean, there are problems with soft springs. Okay, so you put your cantilever under a microscope, then you take a thin something, typically an optical fiber, you dip it into glue, you put it on a manipulator, go there, dip it, go away. We use UV curable glue, which is convenient. So you have a glue that is okay, then you put the sphere and then you cure it and then it becomes glass.
I was wondering whether part of the very slow drift can be due to changing mechanical properties in the
glue. Yes, I certainly think that it might be part of it.
They are designed to take long time.
No, that is definitely something, especially also in V0, because you have your cantilever, the glue, and the sphere. You only have 100 nanometers of gold going there. If things dry a bit out and then your gold cracks a bit, or I don't know.
By the way, which is the thickness, the quartz gold?
Gold is 100 nanometers.
100 nanometers.
What I use?
Less than the plasma wavelength of the gold.
Yeah, but if you do the calculation, it's 99.95% of bulk.
Because, you know, the point is that there is a prediction about the change of the Casimir force in connection with the thickness of the mirror. And in some sense, we are the thickness of the mirror is the thickness of the layer of gold on the sphere.
Yes, that's correct. No, I would say, I mean,
this has been measured already by the Poisson.
But
that was between 10 nanometers.
Larger than the plasma wavelength, well, you can assume the bulk approximation. You can use the bulk approximation.
But to give you an idea, even between 10 nanometers of gold and bulk of gold was a change of something like 15% from 10 nanometer. And I go from 100 nanometer. That should be really bulk-like. I mean, in terms of thickness,
wow, okay.
In terms of dielectric properties, might be not about bulk.
You mentioned these very small spheres of nanometer height. What's the correlation length of roughness?
I did not. I only measured them with an SCM quickly. I did not measure with an AFM. Palazansos did, so you can check the Langmuir paper on that.
So roughness of your plate comparable to roughness of a sphere? Or
no, the plates we use have a roughness of less than a nanometer. We use polished sapphire, and then we coat it. After coating, I put in the AFM to check, and the roughness is less than a nanometer. So the plates we use are always flat. That's also when we are going to compare different plates, then the roughness correction is always dominated by the sphere, which is the same in all experiments. So that is a reason to keep this sphere in as long as it is working. And there's another remark, I never touch. I mean, the sphere never touches the sample. So also when I change to a different sample, I never touch the sphere. The whole experiment is a non-contact.
Except in this case.
Experiment. I don't do it also. I mean, this is a criticism to people who use the contact to calibrate certain parts of their instrument. Because for example, when you modulate the plate a bit, and I had huge problems to understand, because then I wanted to use the motion of this guy. Let me tell the story in the proper order. I did not have a fiber optic interferometer first. So I was just moving the plate. I didn't know the phase. Then I said, but I don't really care, because when I go to contact, anyway, when the plate goes up, the sphere goes up and down, so I can simply use the signal from the AFM to calibrate the motion of the piezo. Then it turned out that all my forces were the other way around. Because, I mean, what was happening, that actually when the plate was going up, my signal was saying that the sphere was going down. I didn't know that yet. That is due to this effect. So then you make you start to think of the most crazy forces in the universe to have a golden air going up, going repulsive instead of attractive, and you start to worry. And then it turned out that it's actually you cannot use the contact as a calibration of your motion. So that's why I put a fiber optic interferometer to know what is going on.
It seems to me that those work is again related to the idea that you want to determine experimentally these d norms. Why don't you use it as a fitting parameter when you compare with theory?
Well, you are asking me all the time the slope of the in the double logarithmic plot.
No, no,
if you have d naught as a free parameter, you can get any slope you want.
No. I mean, you have a curve. I mean, the theory is giving you a curve, and then you don't know where to put it horizontally. Yeah? Right. You use it as a fitting parameter, and then posteriori you try to understand what you get out of the experiment is reasonable.
The trouble with that is it can be really misleading. Let's say you have a layered surface. You start playing that game, you can make it look like it's a semi-infinite surface just by setting up. So there are problems of making it too much the way you want to think of it being.
Yeah, I think the D-naught is a too important parameter to get from a fit.
I asked him the question, because I just want to see how much he needed to get it to be straight. And I don't know if it's a good thing to do all the time, because it's going to change.
I mean, what I can tell you, when I was doing...
I agree with you, but anyhow, you have to, the data, you have a curve.
But sorry, you measured
the global field, okay?
Oh, with electrostatic force. Don't measure. I fit.
You fit, so it's also fitting parameter.
Yeah, but not to the Casimir force.
Yeah, but seemingly you don't want to fit it for the Casimir force, but you do something complicated, and then you are introducing other reasons for uncertainties. So do it at the very end, no? I don't know.
At least do it to see what happens. But then,
yeah, exactly.
I think it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And you can easily fool yourself. I know when I was doing my master thesis, I just did the AFM way, switching on the machine, gathering data, and check what you have. Nice force curve, fitting with D0, the data was perfect. I mean, it really matched perfectly.
I mean, it cannot be. I mean, if there is a difference, can we? Because you are fitting a curve.
Yeah, but you have an error bar everywhere. And that makes fitting not too... That's also, I mean, that's why we do all the examination of all the error bars, so that if you really are going to compare with theory, you at least know at every distance what the error is you have, and then you can...
You have to, once you have the data set, with the error bars, and you take your theoretical curve with the error bars, and you denote as a fitting parameter, then you see what...
Yeah, you could do it. I mean, if you give me a very good theory, then we can do it and see how much the two D0s differ. Yeah. I mean, that would be interesting, because maybe...
I'm all interested in universal things. So.
But then you could see maybe how the electrostatic force is influenced by the roughness by using the Casimir force to calibrate. And you can reverse the system if you have a very good Casimir theory for that.
Yeah, basically, you're not interested in the experiment.
See, it used to be that a court astrologer. Now he wants a court theoretician.
No, court jester. Yes,
okay.